From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a comic who's used his wholesome good looks to spoof middle-class life. We meet Martin Mull. Early in his career, he co-starred in the late-night parody of soap operas Mary Hartman, Mary Hartman. Now he co-stars on Roseanne. In addition to his acting, comedy, and music, Mull paints. His art is collected in a new book. Also today, covering the O.J. Simpson trial, we talk with David Margalek, who covers the trial for the New York Times. He used to write the Times legal column called At the Bar. And TV critic David Bianculli warns us about some of the imitations that are likely to be spawned by this year's TV hits. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Britain and France are preparing to increase their military strength in Bosnia if necessary. British Defense Minister Malcolm Rifkin says the two countries are setting up a rapid reaction strike force to protect United Nations peacekeepers. Britain has already started sending troop reinforcements to Bosnia to protect the 3,400 British troops already there. Two environmental groups who studied water quality have concluded there's a lot of bad tap water in America, and it's going to get worse. The Natural Resources Defense Council and the Environmental Working Group pored over government statistics on water quality for 1991 through 1994. Spokesman Richard Wiles.
In 1993 and 1994 alone, 10 million people drank water that had too much lead in it. 11 million people filled their glasses with water tainted by fecal matter. And millions more Americans sip water contaminated with pesticides, chemicals, or radioactivity at levels deemed unsafe by federal health authorities.
The report says the worst water is in New York City. 6 million people there drink less than clear tap water. In Malibu, California today, Governor Pete Wilson signed an executive order rescinding two decades of affirmative action policies affecting hiring and the awarding of contracts by state government. NPR's Ina Jaffe reports.
Affirmative action programs in California are required by state law, so Governor Wilson's executive order will only eliminate the ones that aren't specifically contained in the statute. Temporary state employees, for example, will no longer be hired according to affirmative action guidelines. Wilson says this is just the first step in eliminating what he calls a vast system of preferential treatment for women and minorities. He also supports a proposed ballot initiative that would overturn the state's affirmative action law. Wilson's executive order was also designed to boost his sagging presidential campaign. The governor's been unable to speak following throat surgery last April. In a statement, his campaign chairman said that the executive order reminds voters that while the other candidates are talking about affirmative action, Pete Wilson is acting. I'm Ina Jaffe in Los Angeles.
Kmart is closing several dozen of its discount retail stores in the United States. 5,800 jobs will be lost. Mary Lorenz is a spokeswoman for Kmart.
Most of these stores are smaller, older stores, the majority of which have not been refurbished or expanded. Many of them are in smaller markets where we don't have maybe the economic base to support our store there.
But Kmart is also saying its store modernization program is on schedule. There's about 150 new stores coming, expansions or refurbishments planned for this year. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is unchanged this hour at 4,465. This is NPR. The search continues for survivors from last Sunday's earthquake in the Russian Far East. Fears that the death toll will reach 2,000 remain. And while most of those pulled from the rubble are dead, there are some miracle stories. NPR's Ann Garrels reports.
Just before dawn, a crane lifted the concrete slabs that had fallen on a discotheque, crushing 40 teenagers. But amid the tragedy, sniffer dogs found five places where people are still thought to be alive. Painstaking efforts brought out 30 corpses from the rubble, but three children were extracted, showing signs of life. The discovery of a three-month-old baby bolstered exhausted rescue workers. According to a top official in Sakhalin, the unnamed girl is perfectly fine. Those who haven't been rushed to the morgue or hospitals live in tent camps alongside their ruined apartment blocks, waiting for the bodies of relatives to be uncovered. Authorities say without water, those trapped in the ruins of Neftegorsk will not be able to last longer than five more days at most. I'm Ann Gerrels in Moscow.
A black protest leader says his son is being framed for a fire at an Alabama high school. 25-year-old Christopher Johnson is accused of burning the school where a white principal had said he'd ban the prom if mixed-race couples attended. Johnson's father is a critic of the school system. He formed a Black Panther militia organization just before last August's fire. Christopher Johnson's father, Emmett, says the FBI is out to get him and the Panthers. He says his son is innocent. The government says Americans' personal income and spending both rose 0.3% in April. Both are what analysts had expected. The rise in incomes was the smallest in 5 months and is the latest sign of a slowing economy. The Commerce Department says that March incomes were boosted by big farm subsidies and bonuses for auto workers. Disposable income, or the income we have left after taxes, dropped 0.7%. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Martin Mull has used his bland suburban good looks to create quirky comedy. He now co-stars on Roseanne as Leon, Roseanne's former boss turned business partner. Back in the 70s, he co-starred in the series Mary Hartman, Mary Hartman, a sicko late-night parody of soap operas in which he played wife-beater Garth Gimble. Then Mull hosted Fernwood Tonight, a parody of The Tonight Show. In 1984, he created a series of fake documentaries called The History of White People in America. His movie credits include Mrs. Doubtfire, Mr. Mom, and My Bodyguard. Before launching his acting career, Mull did stand-up comedy and musical satire. And before he did any of that, he painted. In fact, he's still painting. His artwork is collected in his new book, Martin Mull, Paintings, Drawings, and Words. He has a current solo exhibition at the Cleveland Center for Contemporary Art. I asked Martin Mull when he started to paint.
I cannot recall a time when I was not painting. According to my parents, who are pretty much the authority on those years before the age of five, I was never without a pencil from about the time I was 3 years old on, and I can attest to recent history that that's true. I had someone come up to me the other day and say they'd never known this side of me. I don't even consider it a side. I consider it the front.
You went to college at the Rhode Island School of Design.
Yes.
What different phases as an artist did you pass through during your college years?
Oh, gosh. They went from everything from territorial to historical to pharmaceutical. Whatever phases were basically up for grabs. This was during a very libertarian time in our country's history, the late 60s, when everything was kind of sex, drugs, and rock and roll. So art school was definitely at the forefront of all those movements. There were times when I was very eager to jump on the current art bandwagon and to get very minimal, if that's what was happening, or to get very popish, if that's what was happening. And then ultimately, it all seems to come back down to ground zero again, and just you have to honestly deal with yourself. But I would say I went through the gamut.
How would you describe the work you're doing now?
It's extremely personal. It's more like, in a way, trying to reinvent my own being by examining those things that have happened to me over my life from a subconscious point of view. It's rather difficult to describe. It's trying to allow work to come through me, and I realize it can't come through me out of whole cloth. It has to come from experience, such as the nature of being a human being. But there are experiences that are not consciously conjured up, that they more tend to flow through.
You've said that to say that art school changed my life would be a vast understatement. It created it. How did art school change your life?
Well, let's see. I'm sure that's probably more literate than it need be, but I actually do feel very much that way. I grew up in northern Ohio in a very small little agrarian community and was wearing, you know, jeans and muddy boots to school, and then I moved to Connecticut for 2 years, and all of a sudden everyone was in a Mercedes and in a crew neck sweater that cost more than my father made a year, and then finally went to art school again, and all of a sudden everyone was back in jeans and muddy boots, and I thought, well, that's more like it, and I realized that I could be an adult in that world, and the kind of questions that had kind of kept me an outsider prior to that were now not only acceptable, but necessary. And it seemed like I actually blossomed at the time. I felt like I became alive then.
How did the people around you when you were growing up fit into the history of the white man period of your persona?
Oh, my little show there, The History of White People in America. Well, I would have to say everyone I met from the time I've been born was grist for the mill, and probably a great deal of it was from northern Ohio. The interesting thing about that, I wrote those books and those television shows with a fellow named Alan Rucker, who is from Bartlesville, Oklahoma, excuse me. And one day we were sitting down over lunch and just started swapping hometown stories, at which point we realized that these two are sister cities, the same as Nice and Beverly Hills are. And out of that is what happened. What happened was that we created the History of White People in America. We realized there was a whole legacy there, and we came up with a title first and sold the series and the books without anything more than a title.
I guess it is a good title.
Yeah, it was catchy, I guess.
So what for you defined growing up very white?
Well, now to me, I've talked about this at length, and I can actually get a little bit more serious here, I guess. But
feel free to be funny, too.
Well, if I can. there's a rootlessness that whereby other minorities, and I'd have to say that the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant is rapidly screaming toward minority here in this country, as diversity seems to be taking over, whereby the traditional Jewish comic from the Borscht Belt can get up and just has a wealth of tales that go back for generations and generations and millenniums, you know, that he can draw upon. The black comedian the same way. The poor Anglo-Saxon can basically go back to about Thursday. There's very little history, very little legacy, and a kind of rootlessness that leaves us to the point where ultimately we're forced to talk about the crabgrass in our lawn or what kind of mileage we get on the Buick.
So did you come from a neighborhood where the crabgrass and the Buick were big issues?
Well, I came from a neighborhood where we knew about people like that. We were a little farther down the food chain ourselves. I actually had my best friend when I was growing up. His bedroom was made from an Amana freezer box that had been somehow duct taped onto the side of their house when he unexpectedly came along. So I guess the term white trash could be used by some, but of course I would never say such a thing.
Now, you know how you were saying that Jewish comics, black comics, they had a history to draw and they had a place to fit into, but the WASP comic didn't. So how did you go about fashioning a persona for yourself?
Well, part of my performance persona, I think, was fashioned after other performers, and especially other performers who seemed to be up the creek without a paddle, the ones that were totally at a loss. By that, I would mean like very, very local radio or television personalities. Hence, when I did Fernwood Tonight, the host of that show was one of these people who is an under-equipped, overachieving performer. That was the kind of persona I wanted to go for.
Over-equipped, underachieving.
Yes.
What do you mean?
No, you have it just the opposite. It was under-equipped and overachieving.
Oh, somebody's getting by on very little talent.
Someone's squeezing by on very little talent and trying to make the most of it. And, gee, that may be close to the truth.
You also developed this kind of, like, smug, oily public, you know, persona in some of your performances?
Well, that would come hand in glove to what I just said. The under-equipped, but overachieving and refusing to, just undaunted in his ability to ever admit to his failures.
And there was also the sense of In some of the performances, the really square person who thinks he's really hip.
Exactly. Or that he's not only hip, but a major success, even when he's not. I recall once there was a concert when, put it this way, crowd control was not one of our problems.
Right.
Where I think there were only about 8 or 10 people in the audience that would have held about 25,000 or something. And my persona on stage, I immediately said something to the audience about how grateful I was that we did this by invite only. And I certainly didn't want the rest of that riffraff here. And I'm glad you all could show up. And it's sort of like making a virtue of your vice.
Martin Mull is my guest, and he has a new book that's a book of his paintings, drawings, and words. And that's, in fact, the title of it, Martin Mull, Paintings, Drawings, and Words. So is there any connection to be made between your paintings and your comic persona?
Well, I would have to say that my comic persona paid for almost all of the paint used in the making of these works. And if that sounds like a flip answer, it's actually more true than you might imagine.
So you weren't making money selling paintings?
No, not for a long time. And initially, my forays into show business were simply to fund my art. That while I was in college during the folk music scare of the 60s, when that stuff almost caught on, I, like everyone else, was playing guitar. And once I got my master's degree, realized there was nothing but, there was no doctorate, there was nothing but earning a decent living and facing the Vietnam draft at that point. I had to figure out something to do with myself, so I started playing music full time. That led to singing, where I'm a dreadful singer, so that led to talking a lot. And all of this has been kind of a comedy of errors and a series of delightful accidents that I've been able to put a roof over my family doing what I do.
Why don't we hear one of your songs? There's a new Rhino Comedy Box anthology.
Am I in that?
Your song, Men, is in that.
Oh, no, that was written with Steve Martin, and myself wrote that together for Francis Ford Coppola.
For what?
Well, at one point back in 1975, he wanted to do, I'm sure you've heard of Stan Freberg's History of the World Records. You must
mm-hmm,
know those.
Yeah.
Using that as a springboard, he wanted to rewrite the history of the United States for a feature film. And this was, then he got sidetracked into some little thing called Apocalypse Now, et cetera, and kind of lost interest. And plus, he wanted to do it by the time the bicentennial came around, and we finished it about a year late. But Steve Martin, myself, Albert Brooks, Harry Shearer, and a number of other people all got together and wrote a movie on the history of the United States. Steve and I were given certain eras in our country's development, one of which was Columbus finding the New World, and this was a song we wrote for them.
Oh. Well, let's hear it.
Okay.
This was recorded in, what, 1977?
Was it? I don't know.
That's what it says on the liner notes. So.
They never lie.
We'll put our trust in their hands.
Okay.
This is Martin Mull.
Captain Columbus.
Yes, Malarkey?
The men haven't eaten in days, sir.
Yes, Malarkey.
Captain, I don't think you fully understand. I said the men have not eaten in days now.
I heard you, Malarkey. Thank you.
Captain, you've gone quite mad. I'm telling you for the last time, the men have not eaten in days.
Well, force them! You've plenty of men, haven't you?
Plenty, sir.
Plenty of what? Sir!
Men, sir!
What?
Men! What? Men!
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 Men! Men! Men! Men! Men! Men! Men! Men! Men! Men! Men! Men! Men! Men! Men! Men! Men!
It's great to be on a ship with men and sail across the sea. Oh, we don't know where we'll land or when, but it's great to be with men.
It's great to be with men.
Cause men can sweat and men can stink and no one seems to care. Oh, we'll throw the dishes in the sink and clog the drain with hair. Oh,
clog the drain with hair. Oh, men, men, men. It's a ship off.
Now, how did you get on Mary Hartman, Mary Hartman, which, for our listeners who don't remember, it was a really funny send-up of soap operas and Peyton Place?
Well, let's see.
Late night. It was on, what, 11 or 11:30?
Yes,
11.
It was. It was a serial, a soap opera, really. I had gone out to California on the heels of a divorce with a couple of guitars and a suitcase and had been a big fan of Mary Hartman and went to see Norman Lear's organization about the possibility of writing for them, because I had at that point fancied myself capable of doing that and was told that there were no openings and forget it. But I did meet Norman. And then 6 months later, the part of Garth Gimble, the wife abuser, came up, and they asked me to come in and read for it, and lo and behold, I got the part. And it was somewhat terrifying in that the reason I wanted to be connected with the show was I thought it was absolutely hilarious. and that what work I had done as a comedian on stage might stand me in fairly good stead to at least cut my teeth as an actor doing something funny. Unfortunately, the role I got of a wife abuser, I personally, as I sit here right now and at the time as well, find nothing whatsoever amusing about wife abuse. So it was really learning to act a little bit by being thrown in the icy waters.
So how did you get around this?
I looked desperately for anything to try to take the focus off that which I was and that which I was doing. There was one scene, in fact, when I actually even had to, at least the camera had to think that I had actually struck this woman. And it was around a Christmas time, and I grabbed for a little, like, papier-mâché Frosty the Snowman to use as a weapon or anything like that to try to take the onus off it and the sting off it. But I recall at the end of that scene being in a state where I actually had to just go for a very, very long walk. It was horrible.
My guest is Martin Mull. He has a new book of his paintings and drawings. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with actor, comic, and painter Martin Mull. Friendwood Tonight was, I think, one of the early examples of television mocking
at
itself.
At its lowest.
Well, of TV mocking its own programs. The cheesy, small-town, amateur version of The Tonight Show.
Exactly.
And why don't you describe your character as the host?
His name was Barth Gimble. He would wear lime-colored sharkskin suits and atrocious shirts, Hawaiian shirts. Bleached his hair, trimmed his mustache down like Don Ameche, and basically thought, as far as he was concerned, that he was God's gift to the airwaves. And my co-host was Fred Willard, who was probably one of the best improvisational minds of our or any generation. And between the two of us, we basically set television back a quantum leap.
What period of your painting were you in while you were doing Friendwood Tonight? Were you painting then?
Yes, I've never stopped painting. At that point in my life, I was still doing painting backwards on acetate, the way cells are prepared for animation, and doing a series of paintings, mostly starring a small little wooden chair at kind of an askance angle that would be put into various situations. Smallish paintings, maybe the largest 18 by 24 inches, but all done with vinyl paint on acetate.
Now, have you over the years showed the people who you worked with in show business your paintings? And I could think of a couple of reasons why. One is so that they could be very impressed with your work. Another is so they could just learn more about you. And still a third is some people in show business are very wealthy and maybe they'd buy some.
Well, number three, I would reverse the order. The nice thing about some of the people in show business is they are kind of depression-proof. They do have this kind of slush fund that allows for the buying of art. Steve Martin, whom I mentioned earlier, is a dear old friend and also one of the preeminent collectors of contemporary art in this country today, has been more than kind toward me. I think over the years he's purchased about 19 of my works. And I now hang in his living room along with the likes of de Kooning and Diepenkorn and Cy Twombly and Franz Klein, so I'm very honored about that. And Norman Lear as well has purchased some works. They've been very, very kind and very supportive.
That's great. Well, after, you know, mocking TV on Friendwood Tonight and Mary Hartman and everything, you ended up where you are now on Roseanne, you know, mm-hmm. one of the top-rated shows for years, the top-rated show,
mm-hmm.
Playing Leon, who you got hired to be her boss.
Right.
How did you get on Roseanne?
Well, at that time, Roseanne and Tom Arnold, who was her husband, lived a few doors away. I had known Rosie for a couple of years prior to that. We had done some local talk shows and were just kind of friendly as we met each other on the street kind of thing. He mentioned that there was a possibility, would Roseanne like would I like to come on and play Roseanne's boss? And since at that point I was not on a series and it was the number one show on television, that was probably one of the dumbest questions that has ever been asked me. You know, I just was basically when, where, how much, I'm there. So I took the job without even another thought. He then mentioned that there was going to be something unique about my character, in this case, that I was gay, and I am not in real life, but I thought a bit about this, and on the one level, I realized that no one really believed that Eddie Murphy was Gumby, so I was probably all right in that respect, and that my real concern, however, was that people from the gay community might feel very short shrifted because, you know, there are so many capable actors that could have played the part, and here they go and get a straight guy to play this, and that I could take a lot of heat and a lot of flack for that. But on the contrary, we've actually won awards for the portrayal of Leon Karp, and so I feel very good about that.
Martin Mull is my guest, and he has a new book of his paintings. Now, I want to go back to 1980, which I think is the year that you were diagnosed with terminal cancer.
Yeah.
I guess they were wrong.
Yeah, they were. And the Marcus Welby Award for Bedside Manner has to go to this bozo from UCLA who called me up and gave me 2 years to live over the phone.
Oh, no.
Which right there, it occurred to me, could be cause of death.
Wow.
You know, phone call, cause of death. That's what the autopsy would have to list. I mean, to get this kind of news over the phone, I don't know. And they were all set to inject me with some sort of cow bacillus, something that, you know, Elsie Borden is running around with out in her limbs, and you know the kind of spots they have on their skin. So it turned out that actually my dermatologist had gotten all of it, but it was at that point diagnosed as terminal melanoma, and needless to say, gave me great pause. It also tended to shift my gears rather dramatically in terms of where I was going to focus my energies for those 2 years or for whatever years I have left.
So how did you change gears after you were given this prognosis?
Well, painting became the most important thing in my life at that point. And
why?
Because I realized it was probably the truest thing to me, that it was the area where I wanted to do the most work. I also shifted my marital situation changed. I shortly thereafter remarried my wife, Wendy, whom she and I have been together now for 15 years, and I have a lovely 9-year-old daughter, and just kind of got my ducks in a row and put my values where I think they should be. Just, you know, a glimpse of mortality will do it.
Well, how long did it take before they told you that you were in the clear?
It was probably about 6 or 7 months before everything seemed to be settled down to the point where I actually felt I could start a James Michener book.
Right. Were people afraid to hire you afterwards?
No, because I didn't say anything. I kept it to myself.
Well, that must have been hard to do, though.
No, not really.
So nobody knew that you had cancer, and therefore you didn't have to worry about how you were going to make your reentry.
Yeah, pretty much.
How did you explain your absence? Or was nobody noticing?
Well, let's face it. There are times when I could be absent for a couple of months from any situation and it would not be noticed too badly. I remember coming back and Terry Garr and I did a show for HBO called Here Comes Summer. And I remember still having my back bandaged during the shooting of that. That was my first time back. So I was still fresh from the operating table, but went back to work, and no one was the wiser.
Well, Martin Mull, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Martin Mull's new book of paintings, drawings, and words is published by Journey Editions. He has a current solo exhibition at the Cleveland Center for Contemporary Art. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. David Margalek is taking a short break from covering the O.J. Simpson trial for the New York Times. Coming up, he talks with us about the trial's coverage in the Times and the tabloids. Margalek used to write the Times legal column called At the Bar. And TV critic David Bianculli looks back on the past TV season and looks ahead to the next one. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The United Nations says Bosnian Serbs have taken yet another UN observer hostage. NPR's Andy Bowers is in Sarajevo. He says the new hostage wasn't a soldier.
This happened in the Serb-controlled town of Banja Luka in northern Bosnia. There was a UN civilian official there. This is the first civilian official who's been taken hostage. He was a Swedish humanitarian official. And he disappeared, and the UN is now assuming that he's been taken hostage, and he joins the ranks of more than 370 other UN personnel who are now either detained directly or surrounded by the Serbs.
The Serbs have been grabbing UN peacekeepers for the last several days, ever since NATO warplanes attacked Serbian ammunition depots near their headquarters. UN officials say about 370 peacekeepers are being detained or surrounded by rebels throughout Bosnia. President Clinton is in Montana today. He's visited a wheat farm north of Billings, where he discussed farm policy issues with local residents. He is to hold an hour-long town meeting tonight at a Billings television station. Yesterday, Mr. Clinton discussed his policies on the American West and accused Republicans of demonizing him and his proposals. The president's efforts to increase fees and restrictions on grazing, mining, and logging on federal farmland have provoked bitter opposition from some Westerners. The president has also met with national park rangers who have been threatened by groups that see government officials as a threat to them. The FBI has arrested a 25-year-old black man and charged him with the arson fire last year that destroyed a high school in the East Alabama town of Wadawi. Angela Mann of member station WTSU reports from Montgomery.
Christopher Lynn Johnson of Ashland was arrested without incident. Authorities would not comment on possible motives or whether Johnson is believed to have accomplices. The school burned after months of controversy in Wadawi. The town divided after the high school's white principal threatened to cancel the spring prom because of his concerns about interracial dating. In addition to arson, Johnson is charged with the possession of a destructive device not registered to him. In a telephone interview, the high school's new principal said he was always confident an arrest would be made in the arson case. For National Public Radio, I'm Angela Mann in Montgomery, Alabama.
Air Force investigators are picking through debris today from a fatal plane crash in Wichita Falls, Texas. Two people died and about 20 were hurt when the T-38 plane from Shepherd Air Force Base crashed into an apartment complex yesterday. Most of the injured suffered smoke inhalation and bruises. The two pilots ejected safely. On Wall Street, stock prices closed at a higher for a second straight day. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 7.5 points to close at 4,472. This is NPR. Two former executives with American Honda Motor Company have been convicted of accepting kickbacks in a nationwide scam. Dennis Joselyn, the former West sales manager, and John Billmeyer, former senior vice president, were found guilty of taking bribes from dealers in return for favorable treatment in getting prized cars and dealerships. The two other executives were accused of receiving $15 million in expensive items. Two former dealers, an advertiser, and a lawyer pleaded guilty earlier to other charges, including racketeering. A government health report released today may reduce some of the fears about reformulated gasoline. A Wisconsin study says the cleaner burning gas is not causing widespread health problems in Milwaukee. Chuck Quirnbach of Wisconsin Public Radio has details.
Hundreds of Milwaukee area residents complained of headaches and nausea after sales of reformulated gas started here last December. Wisconsin health officials working with the EPA and Federal Centers for Disease Control have concluded that Milwaukeeans were more likely to report symptoms if they had a cold or flu, smoked cigarettes, or were simply aware of the gas. Wisconsin Division of Health Administrator Ann Haney says the fuel itself is not making people sick.
They were part of another ailment, most likely, and not necessarily directly or related to the use of reformulated gasoline.
Haney says the study does not rule out subtle health effects or the possibility that some people may have a greater sensitivity to reformulated fuel mixtures. For National Public Radio, this is Chuck Quirnbach in Milwaukee.
The new director of the National Hurricane Center says he's ready for the Atlantic hurricane season, which begins today. Robert Burpee, a veteran hurricane researcher, has been nominated to the post to succeed Bob Sheets, who's retired. Burpee's approval is expected soon. He says this year could bring increased storm activity. I'm Korva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. David Margalek is taking a brief break from covering the O.J. Simpson trial for the New York Times. We invited him to tell us what it's been like. Margalek also covered the trials of two other people he describes as marquee defendants, Lorena Bobbitt and William Kennedy Smith. Margalek used to write the Times legal column called At the Bar. Over 100 of those columns are collected in his new book, At the Bar, The Passions and Peccadillos of American Lawyers. As he writes in his introduction, America can't make up its mind about lawyers. It reviles them, relies upon them, respects and ridicules them. His columns documented every aspect of the changing legal profession and explored Americans' often contradictory response to lawyers. Margalek nearly became a lawyer. He studied law, but never practiced. I asked him if he considers the O.J. Simpson trial a plum assignment or hardship duty.
It's a plum assignment in the sense that everybody is paying attention to what you write. I have probably more of an audience now than I've ever had for stories before. In many other ways, it's hardship duty. I mean, personally speaking, I'm living away from home for 9 months. That's not easy. I'm writing for an East Coast deadline of a West Coast trial, which is going to extend even further now if Judge Ito's new hours are put into effect. In a sense, it's not, you know, it's I'm competing against the whole gamut of journalists and, you know, journalistic organs. That's very, very difficult because I can't compete against people who pay for stories. I can't compete for space, in a sense, with the local paper. I can't compete for the kind of prurient interest that a lot of journalists approach this thing with. I mean, that's just not the way that we do things. And I also have a million people second-guessing me.
About what?
You know, just if my judgments don't mesh with theirs or if I miss something, which has happened from time to time.
What was one of the big controversies behind one of your stories?
Well, I mean, I did one story. Probably the biggest controversy from any story that I've written was when I quoted the National Enquirer in one of my pieces. And, you know, the New York Times is not supposed to acknowledge that, A, that the National Enquirer or any tabloid publication exists. This is in the minds of some people. And, B, certainly not acknowledge that they've broken any stories in the case. And I didn't choose to do that. They're part of this equation. And so I put them in, and I had my head handed to me by various sort of journalistic superegos, these self-appointed critics who go around and sort of monitor media performance.
What did you quote them as saying?
Well, first of all, I did a story about them. I did a long feature story about their importance in the case. I didn't get faulted so much for that because that was more reportorial, but I quoted them. You may remember that there was some controversy over whether or not O.J. had confessed to Roosevelt Greer when Reverend Greer visited him in prison. And the Enquirer had reported that O.J. had exclaimed that he did it. They were the only ones who actually went into what O.J. purportedly said. And I thought that it was worth, I didn't build a whole story around it, but I thought that it was worth reporting. And I put that in the story. I put it sort of in the middle or toward the end of the story that I wrote, saying that, you know, there was this whole controversy over whether or not what the guards had overheard O.J. say was admissible, and that only one publication had actually reported what he had supposedly said. And that's what I was criticized for. My own feeling was that it was out there, that other people were reporting it, and that my readers could be trusted to conclude whether it was entitled to any credence or not.
Do you keep reading the tabloids to see how they're covering the O.J. trial?
You know, I read them intermittently. I probably should, if I were doing my job more conscientiously, I should read them all the time. Not because anybody is making me do it, but I think it's just, as I say, it's part of the story. Not all of them. I mean, you know, most of them report nonsense, and I wouldn't believe anything in them. But I think that the Inquirer, in particular, has a decent batting average on this. Now they're reporting this week about the plea bargaining, and I don't think I would have reported that because everybody is denying it, you know, including most recently Johnny Cochran, you know, on the record in court. They've reported that before. I mean, they've been wrong about some things too, but I think that a conscientious reporter should read them and maybe one or two other publications. You know, for instance, nobody wants to admit it, but the transcript of O.J.'s conversation, interview with the police, was first reported in The Star. And, you know, when people need that transcript in the press room, you'll see copies of The Star floating around, you know. We can pretend that it doesn't exist, but it's true.
How do you think your take is different? I mean, what guidelines do you work with about not just the information that you can include, but the amount of analysis that you feel you can put in?
Well, I think that's changing, too. I think that, you know, as with newspapers in general, we're becoming more analytical about everything that we write. And, I mean, we've become like sports reporters in a way. I mean, people who, you know, the person who writes about the ball game for the time, the Yankees game the night before, can't just put in a blow-by-blow description anymore because people are listening to it on the radio or watching it on television. I try to be careful about this, but I'm taking greater stylistic and analytical liberties than I would have done a few years ago.
What's an example of something analytical that you were able to say now that you think you wouldn't have said if you were covering this trial years earlier?
Well, maybe, you know, sort of putting in a paragraph about how stringing together all the various defense theories in the case. You know, the defense wants you to believe that, you know, if the defense is to be believed, drug dealers who are really out to kill Faye Resnick killed Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Goldman by mistake. And then at that point, a police department that had always pampered O.J. Simpson instantly hatched a conspiracy to frame him. You know, just stringing together all of this stuff. I mean, laying it all out. I mean, it's all factual, but laying it all out in such a way that the tenuousness of it all is apparent to people. And not just sitting back and pretending that you know this stuff is as plausible as anything else that's being said in court. Of course, you know, you get in trouble when you do that. People. I remember I got a letter from somebody, from an angry reader saying, you know, the defense is coming up with one cockamamie theory after another. How can you know? And you report it, you know, credulously, as if this stuff is to be taken seriously. How can you do that? And I wrote him back and I said, you know, I try to put this stuff into some kind of perspective and suggest that it sounds a little bit far-fetched. I said, but if I said it any more explicitly than that, you'd be the first to accuse me of being biased.
My guest is David Margalek. He's on a brief break from covering the O.J. Simpson trial for the New York Times. He used to write the Times legal column, and those columns are collected in his new book, At the Bar. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Back with David Margalek. He's covering the O.J. Simpson trial for The Times, the New York Times, and has a new book called At the Bar. Do you feel that the prosecution or the defense has tried to use the press in any way?
Oh, sure. Yeah, all the time.
Do you feel like you've been used at all? Not that you've played along with it, but that someone has tried
well,
to
no,
use
I,
you.
Well, no, oh, sure. You know, I mean, we're being spun all the time, you know? I was, you know, a defense lawyer told me that they were going to file a long collection of grievances against Judge Ito, for instance. This is just one example. And I reported that, and it never happened. And I think one of the reasons it never happened is that Ito read that they were about to do it. And, you know, at least to their satisfaction, they felt he mended his ways. So in that sense, we're being used all the time. You know, and we're using them, I suppose, in the same way. It's just inherent in the business. I don't resent them for it. You know, that's just part of that's how it's done.
You know, you write in your new book that these celebrity trials have created a new breed of lawyer commentators who are really becoming quite famous now.
It's absolutely true. In fact, one of the commentators had a party the other night here in Los Angeles for his fellow commentators. And he came up with a term for us, the commentocracy. There's a whole commentocracy here. There are many of them. Many of these lawyers are going to have to be dragged kicking and screaming back to the practice of law. They're never going to want to do it. I mean, this new glamorous life is just too hard to resist. I know of several people, in fact, who are planning alternative new careers as commentators.
Oh, that's interesting. Have you ever served on a jury?
You know, it's funny that you ask. I did once. I did, and it was a fascinating experience.
What kind of case was it?
It was a murder case.
Wow.
It was a murder case in New York City, and I was, you know, I got my notice for jury duty, and I felt for sure that given my background and my work, I would never be allowed to stay on the jury. And when they were in the middle of the voir dire, I was called down to the bench, and the two lawyers consented, and the judge consented, and I think it was because they thought that I would write about it, and they weren't necessarily averse to that possibility. You know, I mean, for them it was just a garden variety case. For me, it was very exciting, and I must say, very reassuring about the jury. I have great faith in juries. I suppose I'm naive about that too, but I know how I have some insight into how conscientiously a jury can perform. And this was a very interesting case about a mailman in Harlem who was caught in a crossfire between drug dealers. And it was very sad. It was very moving. And the only people in the courtroom were the wife and the children of the man who died.
What did you learn about juries or about yourself as a juror that made you feel so good about the jury system?
Well, I just I sat among these people, and I heard how deliberate and attentive they were, and how seriously they took their jobs. There were people in there who were sort of holding out, who wanted to make sure that the defendant, who was, you know, the kind of person that one might think a jury of middle class people wouldn't care about. He was sort of a drug runner, and didn't make any difference. There were people who were looking out for him. It happened to be an easy case because the defendant had not actually pulled the trigger, but he was part of the transaction, and so his intent became less important. It was much simpler, and that's eventually what it went out on. We convicted him, but it was sort of an easy case. And yet at the same time, there were people who were extremely reluctant to do it and had to be convinced, and that's what's supposed to go on in a jury room.
Do you think The Times is giving more room to the famous cases of the day, whether it's, you know, Bobbitt or William Kennedy Smith or O.J. Simpson, than they might have in the past?
My inclination is to say yes, and that once upon a time they never would have covered something like the Bobbitt case. In fact, there were two Bobbitt trials, and we barely covered the first one. And I was sort of parachuted in at the middle of the second one. I think that, you know, there was... there was some uncertainty as to whether or not this thing was important or not. You know, I mean, one doesn't have that kind of question with O.J., but there was no great legal principle involved in the Bobbitt case, and yet at the same time, the whole world was talking about it. And I think that poses a problem for mainstream, the mainstream press.
What's the problem?
Well, the problem is, you know, you don't want to get caught up in this undertow, and you don't want to just write about titillating but ultimately insignificant things. But by definition, if everybody is talking about something socially, it's significant. And so you compromise, and you know, you send somebody in late, and you vow not to cover it unless there's something significant happening in the case, you know, that can be elevated into a more important legal question. And then, you know, as it turned out in the Bobbitt case, when the verdict came back, when the jury came back and let her off, it was the off lead in the paper, which is a technical term for saying it was above the fold on the left-hand side with a picture. It was the second most important story in the paper that day. So that's the evolution that often happens.
Listen, you know, one thing that everybody will always remember about the Lorena Bobbitt trial is that it was the first time network anchors said the word penis during newscasts.
Right.
How did you handle that? Did you have any guidelines about that?
I think that, I think that for a time the rules were relaxed a little bit, and it made its way into the paper much more freely than it ever had before, including at least one instance, a headline. I think that probably the pendulum has swung back some, but it's no longer verboten.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can use it. I also remember that during the Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill business, when Long Dong Silver was being, you know, was part of the story,
mm-hmm.
newspapers couldn't ignore it, and it had to be in there. You know, it was part of the story. And so for a while, people, you know, it was finding its way into stories, but reporters, granted a little bit of license, were working it in gratuitously into unrelated stories. And a memo came around saying, cool it with Long Dong Silver.
David Margalek, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
It's my pleasure, Terry.
David Margalek covers the O.J. Simpson trial for the New York Times. His new book, At the Bar, is a collection of the legal columns he wrote for the Times. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what do you have on Bosnia?
Well, Terry, we'll be hearing from Andy Bowers in Sarajevo about what's happening there. One more hostage taken today. Also from Tom Gjelten about the quandary facing Western policymakers on Bosnia. It seems that Britain and France, which would like to beef up their troops in Bosnia, have run into an obstacle. UN Secretary General Boutros-Ghali says that those changes would change the mission of the UN, and he's against them. Also today, a report on bathhouses and sex clubs in New York. They were very big in the gay sex scene before the AIDS epidemic, and now, once again, those clubs are back. There's a debate among gays whether they should regulate that scene or let the government step in.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Two months ago, when the TV season officially ended, TV critic David Bianculli looked at the final ratings and the high marks for new shows such as NBC's ER and Friends. And he told us how encouraged he was by their success. Now the networks have all released their new schedules for fall, and they too were encouraged by ER and Friends. So much so, in the case of Friends, that our TV critic is now a little discouraged.
It happens every time. One new show takes everybody by surprise by shooting to the top of the ratings one season, and the next season there are tons of imitators just like it, or trying to be just like it. It happened with Dallas and Miami Vice, and with The Cosby Show and Roseanne, and it's just about to happen with Friends. You know a TV show is in overdrive when its theme song gets picked up on the radio. That's happening right now to Friends. And now that the fall schedules are out, it's painfully clear that the rival networks are trying to get by with a little help from their friends. Their versions of it, anyway. If you don't want to see a lot of sitcoms about attractive 20-something people with way too much free time on their hands, watch out for fall. This new sitcom glut is the biggest trend for next year. Last season, the four major networks presented a pretty balanced schedule of new series. 14 dramas, 13 comedies. For the 1995-96 season, there are 11 new dramas on the schedule and 21 new sitcoms. If you count the sitcoms premiering on the dinky little Warner Brothers network, I don't, but you might, the number of comedies shoots from 21 to 26. Another trend worth noting is a seismic shift in the usage of time slots. The first hour of primetime, once unofficially reserved for family viewing, is now officially thrown to the wolves, or at least to the adults. Also, for the second year in a row, the number of news magazines continues to dwindle, which opens up more later hour time slots for mature dramas. You can thank ER for that trend, and I do. It's too early to analyze the new shows for fall, but not to discuss the old ones. The good news is that Homicide, Life on the Street, and Chicago Hope were renewed. But the bad news is that the year's two most innovative series, My So-Called Life and VR5, were canceled. And a total of 18 returning series will be moved around this fall, meaning you might have to change your viewing patterns accordingly. For me, the toughest time shift is that CBS is moving Picket Fences an hour earlier, which puts it right up against The X-Files. But also, there's Mad About You moving to Sunday opposite The Simpsons, and Friends, which now leads off Thursday nights for NBC. And finally, there's the news that Stephen Bochco has come up with his first drama series since NYPD Blue. It's called Murder One, and the plan is to take a single murder trial over the course of an entire season. Yeah, like the O.J. Simpson trial. But the thing here is that ABC's Murder One, which will require instant viewer audience loyalty to succeed, is scheduled smack up against NBC's ER, which viewers aren't likely to give up easily. Unless Murder One is moved from the ER time slot, like Chicago Hope eventually was last season, Murder One is likely to get killed. Then again, so are most of the new sitcoms coming this fall. Imitation may be the sincerest form of flattery, but on TV, it also happens to be the quickest path to failure.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu and Nancy Updike. Research assistance from Becky Cohen. I'm Terry Gross.
What would you think if I sang out a tune? Would you stand up and walk out on me? Lend me your ears and I'll sing you a song, and I'll try not to sing out of key. Oh, I get by with a little help from my friends. I get high with a little help from my friends. Gonna try with a little help from my friends. What do I do when my love is away? Does it worry you to be alone? How do I feel by the...
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Villard Books, publisher of Rage to Survive, an autobiography of Etta James. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, Country Music, we feature the heartfelt ballads and yodeling of Don Walter and the outlaw songs of Billy Joe Shaver. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next archive edition of Fresh Air.